and recollections, and your father's.
Can I have headphones?
Wearing a beanie at LSU.
Oh, okay. That kind of stuff.
How shrimp was used by the Middle Americans in the banana plantations. Uh-huh. The importance of having your own barrel-making facilities. All of those are really important to the story. And you have the barrel-making equipment.
Yeah.
Those are all important because it's hard for people to realize that this is a product that you used to produce by the ton.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
That when you go buy shrimp today, they're almost finger food. And you were shipping them by the barrel, and not one barrel, hundreds of barrels. Yeah. So if you would just sort of reminisce.
Well, okay, I'm going to start with my, at the time that my grandfather started in business. That's the way I know how to tell the story. So that's what I'm going to do. Around 1900 or so, my grandfather was in an orphanage in New Orleans and got out of the orphanage. He got in the, went to work for his uncle at J.H. Dennery Company. It was a bakery and dry goods company at that time in New Orleans. Their names were Levy, and they ran that company. And they gave him a sales territory, which was the lower part of Terrebonne, Lafourche Parish, and St. Mary's Parish, and all of South Louisiana. And so what he would do is he would just make his rounds about, you know, once he'd just start going and making rounds, and probably took him 2 weeks to make all of his rounds by horse and buggy or whatever type of transportation he had at that time. And so one of his places he used to stop was down in Houma and what have you, and they told him that he needed to go down Montague and Little Cayou and Grand Cayou and stuff like that and visit those people down there. And because their communities were developing and they needed some goods to sell down there. So that's what he did. He just followed the little path that brought him down to Byers. And as he would go down to Byers, he would make his sales to different little grocery stores or different people that he ran into and stuff like this. But they didn't have any money because they were very poor. But they had dried shrimp and furs and whatever else. And my grandfather would say, well, I need to sell my stuff. Why don't you give me your dried shrimp? It looks like something I could sell in New Orleans in the Chinatown. And he would take the shrimp back to New Orleans and sell it in the little Chinatown that they had in New Orleans to the Chinese people, and he would get his money. And he would bring it to his uncle and say, here, uncle, here's what I produced this month or whatever it is. And his uncle said, well, you're doing real good down there. He says, you need to go and start your own business with the dried shrimp. He says, that looks like a pretty nice little business. So while he was in Houma one day, he was staying at a boarding house. And he used to like to go on Main Street, and they used to have a little place where he could play cards and had a little ballroom and stuff like that. And the man that owned the ballroom was a man by the name of Shelley Bergeron. And Shelley Bergeron liked my grandfather. He was a young man. He was a man on the go, and he liked to make, do good business and stuff like that. And, he kind of took my grandfather under his wing. And so after a couple of years, he told my grandfather, he says, well, look, he says, why don't we go into business together? He said, you take the shrimp and you sell it in New Orleans. And he says, and we'll become partners and stuff like this. He says, I got all my cousins and relatives and things like that, and we're in business down there, and we can do well together. So at the same time, he told him that there was a man in Houma by the name of Dr. Leon Jaskrzewski, who was owned a canning company, who was canning shrimp, the largest size shrimp. And my grandfather went to visit with Dr. Jaskrzewski. And Dr. Jaskrzewski gave him the name of his broker in California. And his broker's name was Henry Luce. And Mr. Luce was a man of some stature in California because he was in the San Francisco earthquake. And if you survived the San Francisco earthquake and you were there, you were someone of stature. Plus the fact that he was 6'5" and wore one of these great big old hats to even make him look taller. But he was an old lumberjack. But he had moved to San Francisco and had a little brokerage business working, selling different kinds of products all over in Chinatown and all over the place. And my grandfather got in touch with him by letter and sent him some samples of the dried shrimp. And he said that he was going off to Hawaii and also to China on a sales trip. And he was going to take that product with him to see if he could sell it. So lo and behold, when he got back, he wrote my grandfather, and he says, "Leopold," he says, "I have sold a half a boatload of dried shrimp in Hawaii and another half a boatload of shrimp in China." And so my grandfather was kind of amazed at it, and it took him several months to get enough dried shrimp to send over there, but they did it, and that's what started our dried shrimp business in any kind of capacity. And over the years, up till about 1936, my grandfather and his partner and Henry Luce sold up to 2 million pounds of dried shrimp a year to China and Hawaii. And that's part of the story that I know about.
Now, your family owned some shrimp drying platforms.
Yes, we did.
And that's an important part of your story, I think.
Okay. Well, after they started selling dried shrimp, they couldn't, the process had to evolve, and they had to get enough production in order to get the 2 million pounds of dried shrimp a year. So my grandfather and his partner bought boats, and they bought platforms that existed already and had some already built, that were already in production. And some of these platforms were located offshore. It's what we call offshore. It's up in the marsh grasses and stuff like this, and a little bit, you know, at the end of these bayous, like in Four League Bay, Bayou Karen Crow, Bassa Bassa, the Sea Breeze, you know, and all along the coast of Louisiana. And I think my grandfather and his partner owned 3 or 4 platforms at one time, plus other people who own platforms, including the Philippines, Filipinos who were in Grand Isle. And they had Grand Isle, of course, that was called the Manila Village. And they were there for some time before my grandfather had started his business. They were probably there in the 1860s, 1870s, around that area. But in the Terrebonne and Lafourche Parish, it was my grandfather that had started most of drying of the shrimp and stuff like that. And those platforms were built on little stilts floating in the marsh. And the way they made them float in the marsh and be able to support themselves was that they would drive some little pilings down in the ground, maybe 6 or 7 foot down into the ground and 6 or 7 foot above the ground. And in between the two little poles, or the hundreds of poles at that, they would put a little board, and it would support enough weight on those little boards that attach those pilings together to have it just float on the marsh. And above that, they would get cypress and pine and stuff like this, and they would make the platform on top of it, and it was made in waves. It would have a peak, and then it would come down to a valley, and then it would come up to a peak again and down to a valley. And some of those platforms were maybe a football or 2 football fields big, and they made villages around them. And people lived out on those platforms, and they would catch oysters, and they would catch shrimp, and they would trap furs, and they would make their lives out there on those platforms. And some people would be born and die out there on those platforms. The priest had to go out there and make them jump the broom to get married and stuff like that over the years.
Now, how many people would you guess lived on a platform?
Families. It was probably anywhere from, maybe 15 or 20 to 30 or 40 people at a time, I would think, that were out there. So.
Now, when your grandfather was in the business, you know, you had to boil the shrimp.
Sure.
So, was it a brick?
It was a sort of a brick boiler that they made at first, and then later on out of metal. And, they had a blacksmith making big metal pots and stuff. I guess it was similar to those boiling pots that they used in the sugarcane industry. And they would ship cords of wood out there to those platforms in order for them to make the fire. And those platforms, when they were full of shrimp, were quite heavy. And it would sink a little bit in the marsh, you know. But at the same time, and plus the boilers were heavy and the houses that they were on, and so they had to keep rebuilding them because they kept sinking. But they would do it, and it was, that's how they got along. And as time went by, and after the World War II was over with, they started building roads and schools, and the community started to really get bigger and bigger down on the coast, and they built roads down there, and so the platforms came to the end of the roads. And the shrimpers got boats. They used to, by the way, I forgot to tell y'all that they had very few boats in those times, and the people would go and seine those shrimp by hand, and they would catch enough shrimp to fill up the platforms. So it was quite extensive, and the shrimp were very, very plentiful in those days. I don't know exactly how hard it was for them to do it, but it was pretty hard life, so.
Now, your family owned platforms. I think a hurricane changed your mind about owning.
In 1926, a hurricane came and right through Terrebonne Parish and blew away a lot of the platforms. And my grandfather and his partner had a boat, and I forgot the name of the boat. I wish I could remember the name of it. And they sent the boat to go get the people on one particular platform. I think it was out by the sea breeze. And the boat broke down. And they had 9 people left out on that platform, including a little boy that had gone fishing with his daddy. And they got caught on that platform, and 9 people drowned. My grandfather and his partner decided that at that time they were going to try to get rid of this platform because they didn't want to have that responsibility on it. And if people wanted to dry the shrimp, they could do it on their own, and and we would buy it from them, and instead of having all that responsibility. And they parked the boats and stuff behind the shop, and we still had, in fact, one of the masts off of one of the boats is supporting the building in the back end. She would want to go off back in. But
Well, tell us about how you got involved, the company got involved in making barrels.
Okay, well, they were making, so the dried shrimp got so big, and it's falling over in this chair. But the dried shrimp industry got so big that they were shipping the stuff in these 200-pound barrels, and the company in New Orleans that made the barrels was a company called Mancuso Barrel Company. And they sent one of their men, I guess he was a coppersmith, I guess, at that time. But he would come down here, and next door, and we have a little, an old livery stable that's next door. And he was placed in that little livery stable, and he used to make barrels for my grandfather and his partner. And so they could ship the dried shrimp. And what they used to do is they used to get the shrimp from down on the coast. And a lot of times the boats would bring the dried shrimp to the shop here in the back, and they'd all float them in the back. And my grandfather would take them out of the sacks or however they transported it to him, and whatever they transported, and he would place it in these 200-pound barrels. And those barrels probably in the neighborhood, probably a guy would make 100 of them a week or so a week. And my grandfather would ship probably once every couple of weeks or so on the little ferry, the paddle wheel boats that were going up and down the bias here. And they would go through the Barataria Canal and go to New Orleans. And they would catch the steamboat in New Orleans and either pass through the Panama Canal or wherever they had to go to catch those, to get to Hawaii and China and down to Brazil and Argentina and Cuba and Central America. And probably those steamships went down before they went to the, didn't go to the Panama Canal to get to China. I'm thinking he probably railroaded, put the stuff on the railroad, the barrels on the railroad to go to California. And then from California, we'd catch the boat going to Hawaii and China. But the stuff that was going to Central America would go down through New Orleans on those steamships, on those paddle wheel boats. And I don't know, that sounds kind of confusing. But
but you had stencils.
Yeah, we had those stencils.
That you stenciled onto?
Those barrels. Yeah, those barrel stencils. Yeah. Do you want to put some of those in?
What I'd like to do is, I think one of them is Redbud, but you actually had several names.
Oh, yeah. We had several different names for our stuff. We had Redbud brand. We had Baby brand, we had Homer brand, and each, there were lots of people who were shipping dried shrimp as well as we were. And each one of them had their own brand names and stuff like this. And they were all trying to ship in barrels and stuff like that. And you can, some of those, I saw one the other day, it was the Mormon Shrimp Company. And down, but they, this was a box stencil, and it was made sometime after those, the barrels company. But I saw one that my friend has one down on the coast down there. And everybody had like Red Devil brand. I think that was the show band name. And I'm trying to think of Gulf Food Products is the company in New Orleans with Robert Hoy and Mr. Hoy and Mr. Hong. And you know, such like that, but we probably had the most brand names out of anybody. And even today, we still require, sometimes we have to ship under some different brand names and stuff like that, because the people want it from that particular company. So.
Now, how did the industry change when, you know, we've got ability to put shrimp in cans?
Well, the industry changed. They were always putting, fairly canning the shrimp at about the same time that my grandfather went into business as well. But drying shrimp was a way to preserve the shrimp. And for years and months and for God knows how long, a dried shrimp will last. It's supposed to be the safest product in the world, as far as the biologist at LSU told me at one time. And it has no harmful oils or resins or anything in it that get rancid or anything like that. So it stays just almost forever. You know? And if you, because you take it out with bacteria likes to grow in it, which is the water. And it gets down to probably about, maybe at the most, you can get dried shrimp down to having about 6% moisture content into it. If you stop and dry it up enough. We usually, the breaking point is usually around 10-12%. But that's a little scientific stuff, I guess. Maybe y'all should put that in
there. But now, you also mentioned that, well, Was it your father that went to LSU?
Yeah, oh, my dad. You want to know that story? Okay. My daddy started to go to LSU around 1930 or 1933 or something like that. And he was a freshman. And they had built the LSU stadium. And everybody that stayed at LSU stayed, that's where the dorms were in the stadium. And everybody that went there was supposed to be in the ROTC. And my dad, being a freshman, was... I'll start over again. You want to get out of the QuickBooks so you can get in? What you doing, paying bill?
Okay. Sorry.
Not a problem.
My dad went to LSU in 1933, I think. And when he got there, everybody was in the ROTC and staying in the stadium, in the dorms in the stadium. And LSU was an agricultural college at that time. But anyway, the guy that was the head of the ROTC, was, I think he was a captain or a major or something like that. And my daddy was a little intimidated by him, of course, being a young man and everything like this. And one day he had forgot his hat at home in Homer, and my grandfather packed up his hat in a box and wrote on there the address and stuff like that and put his sticker on the box and shipped it off to LSU. And the captain of the ROTC got it. And he called my dad out of class, and my dad, man, beat feet across the quad as fast as he can go. He was nervous as could be, you know. And when he got in his office, the captain of whatever it was told him, he says, "You Lewis Bloom?" He says, "Yes, sir." And he says, "This your hat right here?" He says, "Yes, sir." He says, "Well," he says, "I was looking at this label on the box." He says, "Bloomin' Bergeron, Red Bug brand shrimp." He said, "Is that related to you?" And my daddy says, "Yes, sir." He says, "Well, let me tell you a story." He says, "When I was a young officer, I was stationed in Shanghai, at the harbor in Shanghai, China. And he says, I used to watch those coolies unloading barrels of shrimp from Homer, Louisiana. And he said, Red Bug brand, Bloomin' Bergeron. He says, I often wondered where that shrimp was, came from, and who had sent that shrimp over here. And he says, it always made me a little homesick. And he says, it was a little touch of home. And he had a tear in his eye. And my daddy saw that tear coming down his cheek like that. He says, oh, he says, I got it all right now. And so after that, he says, son, he says, that brought back a lot of memories to me. And so after that, my daddy felt all right being in the ROTC at LSU.
Well, now, how did the industry change when, you know, you don't sun dry anymore?
No, the industry changed around, I would think around 1962, 63. The price of shrimp doubled. In fact, it actually tripled. And before that, when my grandfather first started in business, he was paying the people down on the coast 6 cents a pound to 8 cents a pound for dried shrimp, and he was selling it for 10 cents a pound. And so if they had a round of shrimp, a whole platform of shrimp that went bad because they couldn't dry it because of weather or for some reason or another, it just got rotten sitting on the platform waiting for it to dry, they would shovel the whole thing overboard and just go back to work again. I mean, it was costly, and it cost them a lot of labor and everything like this, but overall, they were catching a lot of shrimp and stuff like this, and so they would just replace it. But when the price of shrimp got up to over a $1, $1.50 a pound, they couldn't afford to throw it away anymore. So my dad, in about 1948 or so like that, he came from New Orleans after working for Higgins Industries in New Orleans during the war and a little bit after the war, came and helped my grandfather in the shrimp industry. And he took our old heater out the bathroom and made himself a drying machine. And he was drying shrimp in an artificial drying machine here in the shop for about 15, 20 years. And after that, he had developed a method of doing it and knew what he needed to do. He had all the tests run on it and found out it was even better than the sun-dried shrimp. And so in about 1962 or 63, when the price tripled, those people said, we don't know what to do. We're going to have to really be careful about how we're drying shrimp. And so my dad says, well, I got an idea. I said, I got a drying machine that I've been drying shrimp with. He says, why don't we come down here and put a drying machine in each one of the platforms and y'all can try it out and see how y'all like it. And it probably cost him about maybe $150, $200 a piece at the time to put a drying machine on their platforms. What they would do is they would get some of these little old-time, people would throw away industrial-type heaters that now you use them in your house to heat your house up. They call them central heating units and stuff like that. And my daddy hooked them up and he put a blower on the back of them. And he built a box about six by 10 foot
wide.
And with the heater blowing underneath in this box, and he had a screen sitting up on the top of the box, and they would pour the boiled shrimp on top of that screen, and the air would be forced through the shrimp, and it would dry it. And anywhere from 4 to 6 hours, depending on the time of year it was, and how much humidity or rain or whatever was going on, it could dry up a batch of shrimp. In that thing, they could put 3 barrels of shrimp in there, which was about the equivalent of about 640 pounds or something like that. And at first, they had a drying machine and they had their platform. And when the weather would get bad, they would try to put as much, you know, they would take the stuff off the platform and they would dry it in the drying machine. But a lot of people who were selling dried shrimp at that time didn't want that shrimp that was coming out of that dryer because they didn't know about it. You know, they didn't know whether it was going to be good or whether it was going to be accepted or anything like this. But my dad knew because he had been doing it for a long time. And so we got a lot of that dried shrimp that came out of the drying machines. And so as time went on, the Board of Health would come and says, oh, we can't have y'all drying shrimp on platforms like that anymore. The birds are coming and dropping that stuff on it, and nutrients and the raccoons are coming up here and eating the shrimp and doing what they got to do, and the maggots are coming and getting in the dried shrimp and everything like that, and it's not sanitary. So eventually they with the you know, new laws and new, you know, safety regulations and stuff like this, they all started using drying machines. And the price of shrimp kept going up and going up and going up. And so it saved all, you don't lose any shrimp today with dried shrimp.
What was the power supply for the blowers?
The blowers, they had electricity.
All right.
That they used at that time in 1960s. They were all, most of the platforms and such were down the bottom. Anybody that was offshore or whatever it is, still dried shrimp the old fashioned. Because either that or they got a generator, but that was too expensive for them to run that to dry the shrimp at that time. And the power support stuff for the gas dryer was a gas dryer. They used gas to dry it. And so they're still using that today. They're still using the same drying machine my daddy put down, those drying machines that they used in those days. And the people that are still in the dry shrimp business are still using them.
Now, explain to us, dry shrimp arrived at this dock. Or where?
There's a dock in the back on the boat.
How did they go from the dock today in a cardboard box.
Mm-hmm.
What's the process? How does the process work to move whatever you get? And the little ladies are out there doing whatever they're doing.
You want me to go through my process?
Yes, please.
Do you want me to tell you how, from this point, did the shrimp come off the boat?
Yep.
Okay. The trawlers go out and they catch the shrimp in their nets, and they put them in the ice holes of their boats. When they get back to the docks, they unload them into a big vat of water. They have ice and everything like this, and this is kind of a way they wash the shrimp out. And out of that vat, it's conveyed and weighed in baskets and stuff like this. And the shrimp that is going to the factory is iced down again and put on the side. The freshest product that they have that they want to dry goes to the boiling machine, and it's put on the side, and they unload the different boats and stuff. When they got enough to boil, they'll transport it to their boiler, and the boiler is just, it's a big old boiling machine where they can boil probably 3 or 4 to 6 boxes of shrimp at a time. And the boxes of shrimp that they use now are 100-pound boxes. And so they'll boil it, and then from there, they'll either wheelbarrow it or they'll have a machine to convey it to the dryers. And they just take it and dump it in the dryers, and they spread it out, and they'll just turn the fan on to cool it off from there. And after it gets cooled down, then they'll start turning the heaters on, and the heaters dry the shrimp. And for a good while before the shrimp dry, it's not as hot as you would think it would be, but like some guys will have 27 dryers. It's not as hot in there as you would normally think. It's because the shrimp has moisture in it, and it's trying to cool off the heat, see? But after a while, it just is overcome by it. And about the last hour to an hour and a half that they're drying the shrimp, the temperature starts rising. And in some of those places, you can get up to 140 to 150 degrees while they're still drying the shrimp. And, you know, in the places. And those people are really, you know, when they have to go and turn that shrimp over or take it, they have to turn all those dryers off and kind of let it air out a little bit. You know, some places have some ventilation. It might get up to 120 or something like that. But I've been in some places where you had to crawl on the floor to get there because your eyes were burning. But it's a hot process that they use. Well, anyway, the shrimp are boiled and put in the drying machines, and their shell and the heads and everything like this. After they're dried, they'll take them, they'll shovel them out back into some barrels or whatever it is, and they'll bring them to the beater, where they're loaded into the beater, and the beater is a big screened barrel, and it's a tumbler, and inside that tumbler. If you've ever looked in your drying machine, you got some little things to make the fold. Same thing with the dried shrimp, to unfold the dried shrimp. And what they do is they turn this drum, and it takes the shell and the head off of them, and the shell and the head crush up, and it falls through the screen. And the meat of the dried shrimp remains, and it stays in that drum. And so we call the stuff that falls out underneath the stuff, the heads and the shells, shrimp bran. And the meat, of course, is dried shrimp. And we sell both. We try to sell the byproduct, which is the bran, and also the meat product that is produced. And we collect it over a period of time. Well, anyways, after they finish beating the shrimp, they move that bran out the way, and they'll get on there, and they'll open up the beater again, and they'll either dump the shrimp into some troughs and shovel it into some sacks for us, or they'll just shovel it into the sacks right out the beater. And from there, I come into play, and I go down to buy, and I pick the shrimp up, and I transport it back here. And from here, I unload it out my truck, and I bring it to the ladies in the back, and they'll put it in my grading machine. And my grading machine is a homemade deal. Some people have some different type of graders, like nut graders and fruit graders or whatever it is that they have adapted to fit the dried shrimp. We made our own machine. And what it is just an old machine that just goes back and forth, and it has different size screens inside of it to grade the different sizes of dried shrimp. And from there, they'll take it and we do what we call blowing it. It blows out some of the trash, some of the stuff that's remaining in a very lighter portion. And then my ladies will be sitting on a belt, a conveyor belt, and the shrimp fall onto this, comes up from the blower and it falls on the conveyor belt, and they'll hand pick it. They'll pick the remaining heads and pieces of fish and trash and everything out of it. And of course, the bigger the shrimp, you know, during the grading process, the easier it is to clean. The smaller the shrimp, the more trash and stuff they'll have remaining in it, so it takes a longer time to clean the small ones out than it does the larger ones. And from there, we pack it in 50-pound boxes, where as it comes off that conveyor, depending on what size they're doing, and we seal it up, and we either put it in inventory or we ship it. And that's the process.
Now, that takes care of the dried shrimp. Now, what do you do with the bran?
The bran, I have a building across town that I store it. And bran is a particular kind of process. We grind it. It's a lot of it is it just basically the shell and heads of the shrimp and what have you. And what we do from there is we have these hammer mills that we grind it up into a finer powder and stuff like this. And it's used as bird and animal food, and also like tropical fish foods and stuff like that. And I sell that to zoos and aquariums all over the United States. And if you've ever seen pink flamingos, shrimp meal has something in there that makes called carotenoid, that makes the flamingos turn pink. And that's what makes them really pink. And today, not long ago, I went to Audubon Zoo and they're using some other kind of formula, probably some beet meal or something like that. And the flamingos are a little bit orange. They're not eating shrimp meal at Audubon Zoo.
Now,
excuse me.
there's a piece of equipment Chauvin and Bergeron developed.
Oh yes, that's the.
Explain what that does.
Well, that beats the shell off the shrimp.
That's the big beater.
That's the big beater that beats the shell off the shrimp. Now, it's been adapted and changed over the years from the original patent that my grandfather's partner and his friend Freddie Chauvin made, and. But the basic principle is still there to do it. And what happened was that in the old days, before they had that beater, the people on the platforms would do what was known as the shrimp dance. And they would, when the shrimp were dry, they would put their moccasins on, or thick shoes, or thick something with thick soles on it, and they would get out on that platform and they would dance over the shrimp in a little line, and they call that the shrimp dance. And they were crushing up the shells off the shrimp. And what they would do after they had all of that done was that they would take a shovel and they would throw the shrimp up in the air, and the shells would go one way and the shrimp would fall back in the shovel, and they would put that in their sacks or barrels or whatever they transported in there. And so one day my grandfather's partner and them were out there on the platform, one of the platforms, and one of the little boys on the platform was running around with a barrel, and he had some dried shrimp in the barrel. And the more he bounced the barrel around on the platform, the more shells came off the shrimp. So it gave him an idea. So that's where to tumble the dried shrimp. And they have that patent that they made that dried shrimp tumbling machine to keep those shells off the shrimp.
Now, so, when did you move from barrels to boxes?
Probably, I would think it probably in the 1950s. I think the Mancuso Barrel Company and must have been right after the war, because they couldn't get the barrel material anymore, and my grandfather was getting a little old and was shrinking down his business at that time, didn't need the barrels anymore. But the man that still that made him moved across town, and I think his family still lives in home, you know, that did that. It was a Wallace. I believe the man's name was a Wallace that did that. But I think it was in the 1950s that they started using wooden boxes, and probably 1955 or so when they changed over to cardboard boxes. Because I can remember when I was a little boy, we used to come and help my grandfather, either putting cards on, you know, putting up little cards of shrimp to sell locally in the grocery stores and stuff, or making boxes. And we used to have, they used to get the glue from the Swift Company. It would be some horse hoof glue. And when as a little boy, we'd take a paintbrush and we'd paint the bottoms of those boxes, and we'd have some bricks. I still got the bricks, by the way. And we'd just put those bricks in those boxes and let them sit there until they dry. I used to make 17 at a time. I can remember that like heck, because that's all the bricks I had. And I used to wear myself out on Saturday or Sunday trying to make boxes of, to put dried shrimp in. And I'd make probably 150, 100 so at a time. And they would ship that.
And you told Carl and I once about your family needed $10,000. You went to a local bank.
Oh, that, yes. My grandfather, when he started in his business, needed to have money to finance to pay the people for their shrimp. And there was a bank in Homer called the People's Bank and Trust Company. And my grandfather went over there one day and asked them if he could borrow $10,000 from them. And they said, well, Mr. Bloom, he said, can you come back in a few days? We'll let you know. And he had been shipping shrimp and stuff like that, and they knew him to be a pretty trustworthy guy and stuff like that. So he went back the next couple of days, and they told him, they said, Mr. Bloom, we met with the board of directors and everything like this, and we've agreed to lend you the $10,000. And my grandfather said, well, I surely thank you for doing that. He says, I know it's at this time, he said, it's a pretty large sum of money. He said, not only is it a large sum of money, it's the whole money that we have to run the bank. They lent him all the money in the bank to buy a shrimp and ship it to China. And that was, I guess that was probably about 1920, 1918 or so, something like that. I don't remember when when that was. But how do you say that? The whole capitalization of the bank was $10,000. Now, you know, that's pretty good. And this business, probably in the 1920s to 1936, was probably one of the biggest business, if not the biggest business in Terrebonne County.
How many people did you employ at that time?
I think my grandfather probably employed probably with the people on platforms and such like that. It was a tremendous amount of people. I mean, I don't know if he paid a lot of them, but they were all getting money out of it for sure. And so, anyway,
we've seen a photograph that says.
What's that? What you looking for?
M&M.
M&M? Just processed it.
Why are you looking? You see it in a box.
Oh, it's one box. Well, somebody already picked it up. Yeah. Who picked it up?
Seen a photograph that says, I think it said Bloom and Bergeron maybe in Mahler fir or aluminum.
Oh, okay.
How did that come to be?
Well, when they started business, they not only were in the shrimp business, they were in any type of business that they could do to do anything. And they had furs here that they were catching muskrats and stuff like this. And my grandfather, being an entrepreneur that he was, had gotten in touch with a company in Chicago, in St. Louis, to sell furs for them. And they had a big fur business here, not only when the shrimp seasons or when they were catching shrimp, wintertime seasons, they would trap furs and stuff like this. And we were in the fur business. And he also was in the candy business and cigar business and whatever, anything he could sell, dry goods and stuff like this. And they owned a farm and all too, and they grew potatoes to sell potatoes and stuff like this. Anyways, the fur business was a big fur business, and some of our buyers were Allie Doe Mahler and Mr. B.M.A. Mard and people like that, old-time people. And I have pictures of that picture with them. It says, used to say on the front of the building, Blooming Bedroom Dried Shrimp and Fur Company. And they would ship those furs, muskrats especially, and to St. Louis and such like that. And they were in the moss business too. They used to sell moss and things like that to the Ford Motor Company. Now, did I tell you that story?
Well, we'll get back to that. Right. I want you to finish
anyways. Back in about, my grandfather was getting a little older and such like this, and the fur business was a little bit too much for him to handle. So Mr. Mahler, who was the guy who used to buy shrimp, the furs for him, they were basically in business together. I don't know if you're referring to the time when my grandfather, during the Depression, is that what you wanted to find out? All right. Well, during the when the stock market crashed, the banks failed as well, and my grandfather had, I guess, a premonition or whatever it was. I don't know what happened, but he didn't deposit his money in the bank, and he went to see his fur buyer, who was Mr. Alador Mahler, and they lived across. Well, now it's across the inner coastal, but I don't know if the inner coastal was built in those days. I don't think so. But he went to see him, and Mr. Mahler was in his kitchen, and he had his head in his hands, and he looked at my grandfather and says, Leopold, he says, I don't know what we're going to do. I said, I got all these people that's working for us, with the furs and everything like that. And he says, I we don't have any money, we can't pay them. He says, the banks have failed. And my grandpa looks at him and says, Mr. Alligator, he said, don't worry too much. He says, I didn't put the money in the bank. And he gave him $10,000 that he had for him. He had $20,000. He gave $10,000 to Mr. Alador Mahler, and then he went down to buy, and he went to saw Mr. Gustav Laperouse. And he was the shrimp man down there for us, and he gave him $10,000. He said, tell those people just to keep working. And that's how that went. And so they were able to keep their business afloat because my grandfather kept the money. But Mr. Mahler, when he saw my grandfather with that money, he got out the chair and he kissed him.
How did you get out of the fur business?
Oh, how did we get out of the fur business? Well, my grandfather was getting older and stuff like this, and so I think he gave that fur business to the Mahler people. Either that or they bought it from him. I don't know of any records or anything like that, but they gave the fur business, and it used to be right down the street.
How exactly did that fur business work? I mean, he had a whole network of trappers.
They had networks of trappers and stuff like this and what have you, and that would come here and they would bring the furs, and Mr. Mahler and my grandfather or whatever it is, they would go out and they would buy. Sometimes they would go out and they'd pick up the furs and stuff like this. And they would bring them here, and they would grade the furs and stuff like that. They used to fill up this building with furs, you know, with the muskrats.
How did they ship?
Mink and stuff.
Did they ship by the bale?
They must have shipped them by the bale at that time. They must have baled them up and shipped them. David, do you remember the name of that fur company in St. Louis that used to buy all those furs from Papaw? We gotta have some record somewhere on that. If I find that, I'm gonna give it to you.
All right.
Let you.
In St. Louis.
St. Louis.
That was with the.
Who would know about those people?
Big fur operation in Victoria. We got a museum there.
In Victoria, Columbia, but.
Right. It's the same company. Big.
Yeah.
International fur operation. And. Oh, they were old.
Yeah. You know who would know about that? It would be the Barkers that owned the Barker Motor Company.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Those people, they were good friends with those people
the
in
Maulers.
St. Louis. Yeah, but not the Maulers, it's the Barkers.
Okay.
And they could tell you, Mike Barker knows. I was talking to him about that not long ago. He remembered the name, Mike.
So you got out of the fur business,
yeah.
But you got into the Spanish moss business?
Well, they were in that already. They used to, that's a good one. That's an even better. They used to sell the moss. They used to dry the moss, wash the marsh and moss out and get the lice and stuff out of it. And they would dry it out on fences and stuff like this. And they would bring that all over here. My grandfather would have to pack that in a certain size wooden container and ship that to the Ford Motor Company, okay, on the train. And the reason why it had to be a certain size container was not only were they stuffing the seats in the Model T Fords with the moss, those little cartons that they used them to make the seats with. The backs of the seats, they had to have it a certain size for them to that was Henry Ford's genius.
Now, were the boxes made of cypress?
I don't know. I'm assuming it probably so. Cypress or something like that. And they used to use quite a bit of that at one time. Now, they had a lot of people that were selling that malt. My grandfather just happened to be one of them.
But he shipped it to the Ford Motor Company.
That Ford Motor Company or...
By rail.
By rail, I'm assuming, yeah. That's what I was told.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. They were in the turtle business. They used to ship the little terrapin turtles. That's the Maryland terrapins. little small turtles. I don't know if they even still exist.
Now, these were the small ones?
No, they were making soup with them. They were
okay.
Making soup up in those restaurants up in, you know, Maryland. And, you know, they're famous for that.
Yeah.
And my grandfather used to sell those. And they used to have those turtles behind Grand Isle. And he would go down there and stay there in Grand Isle and party down in Grand Isle and get turtles and bring them back.
Do you remember how he brought them back?
I think he had a little truck that he brought them back with. They would put that in some sacks or some boxes or something.
But how would they ship them?
He would ship that on a railroad, by rail. Mostly everything went out by rail.
Okay. They got there fast enough, obviously, stayed along.
Yeah. My grandfather could type and he could make papers, you know, bills of ladies and stuff like this. And they used to have people that would come here and bring stuff about when they built the roads to New Orleans and stuff like this. And one of the people happened to be a guy by the name of Mr. Sire, Johnny Sire. And he would go to the market in New Orleans. I think they owned a grocery store, and he needed something to bring to New Orleans. And my grandfather would load 3 or 4 barrels of shrimp on his truck, and other people as well, not just my grandfather, but they would like, and he would transport stuff to New Orleans to have something in his truck, and he would bring back groceries and stuff, maybe for DuPont's or his own grocery store for some other people and stuff like this. And my grandfather would type up, he didn't know how to write, and my grandpa would type up all of his paperwork for him. And lo and behold, the Sire Motor Freight Company got to go. And that was a long time ago.
You know, so that's how it got its start.
I think. You know, that's what I was told.
Well,
so I was, you know, I don't know if that's the actual the part about it. I know that those people were you know, industrious enough. They were able, you know, to do stuff. But my grandfather used to type out paperwork for him. I knew that. I think he's got some of the stuff.
When did you all stop shipping dried shrimp by rail? And I assume you switched.
We used the motor truck lines, yeah.
About when did that change take place?
Well, when the highways and stuff, I guess, when they started building the highways and stuff, and the trucking became more popular than the rail system. My grandfather had shipped to his broker up in New York one time, a rail car full of shrimp, and it got lost in the stockyards up there. And he had to go to New York and get with his broker to go find it in the stockyards. And I kind of remember my daddy telling me, he said that kind of ended his idea about shipping stuff anymore on the freight line. But, you know, that could have been sometime, you know, he wanted to find another way to do it because the shrimp got lost up there. And, there's all types of little stories that my daddy used to tell me about people going into business because of the dried shrimp. I'm going to tell you all another little story. His broker, my grandfather, the broker, called him up one day and he says, I've got two guys that immigrants from Germany in my office. And he says, they're in the pet food business in Germany. He said, but they immigrated to the United States. And they said they interested, they saw that we sold dried shrimp. And he said, but they interested in selling the byproduct, the shrimp dust and stuff like that. He said, that makes good bird food. And so my grandfather sent up a few sacks of shrimp dust up there. And Mr. Hershey called him. He says, what you want to charge you for that? He says, just give it to him. And lo and behold, Hartz Mountain Company started. Now that's far-fetched, maybe, but that's what I understand. And and we're still selling Hartz Mountain today. So, we're still selling.
Now this is, I don't know if Don asked this while I was in the back taking pictures or not, but did you ask about the percentage, the rough breakdown of what went to domestic markets and what went overseas? You know, in the shipments of the
over the years?
Yeah, just a ballpark figure.
Well, when we first started, as I understand it, the first international shipment of seafood from the United States anywhere to any foreign country was my grandfather's business that he shipped to China back in the early 1900s and stuff like that, as far as seafood was concerned. And at least that's what we understand. But before World War II, I'm assuming that probably most of the shrimp that my grandfather sent out of here went overseas because it was very inexpensive. And during the Depression especially, because we didn't have any money here. And in China, they were on the gold standard and the remnants of the Dowager Empress. And their money was good and ours wasn't. So we had a good product to sell to China. And so it was very inexpensive and it was good. And shrimp is red in color from Louisiana and it's something to eat. And so red in China is good luck. And it's also something to eat because they have a lot of famines over there. So it was very good. It was a very good product for them. Plus it was preserved and it never went bad. And so they could use it anytime they wanted. And so I'm assuming that probably most of the shrimp prior to World War II went overseas. Either went to South America, Cuba, or China, or Hawaii, somewhere like that.
Now you mentioned Mr. Luce.
Mr. Luce, yes.
Now, Mr. Henry Luce. He was your broker.
He was our broker.
To China and Hawaii.
Right.
How did you get into the markets in Belize, Cuba, Brazil, Central America.
We had some brokers that were down there at the time. And also my grandfather, I think, knew somebody at the United Fruit Company. And they used to, I think they were in the Whitney Building in New Orleans or somewhere around there with the Whitney Bank, some kind of way with that. And I think that what they would do is that they would ship foodstuffs down to Central America, including dried shrimp, to those plantations down there where they grew the fruit and vegetables, and then they would ship the fruits and vegetables back, and then dried shrimp and stuff like that were used on those plantations. I think they also used to use a lot of codfish from Maine and stuff at the same time. Puerto Rico, their national food, their national, how would you call that, meal or whatever it is made with codfish. And also, they used to use a lot of dried shrimp too down there. And it was a cheap way to feed people that worked on the plantations and such like that. They had tremendous sized plantations in Cuba and Central America, and I think down as far as Brazil and stuff like that. So,
do you have any idea how much, a ton, you mentioned 2 million pounds. So that's 1 million tons. So if you were to say how much went to United Fruit or Standard Fruit, would it be a ton, half a ton?
I just don't know.
You don't know?
I'm just curious. I think they would probably buy a ton or so at a time. I think, so many barrels, 200-pound barrels.
And barrels?
20 barrels at a time, I would think. How many they would, whatever they could put on the boat to ship to New Orleans, that's what they would ship down there.
And a barrel was 200 pounds?
200-pound barrels.
So every 10 barrels was a ton.
Just to give you an idea, my grandfather, when he would load those boats and stuff like this, he would get some guys, some big men, and I hate to say this, but colored guys, and they would pick up those barrels and carry them on their shoulders. That was some strong men in those days to do that.
The dry
shrimp. They had to be exceptionally strong. My daddy used to tell me that he was a little boy, and those guys would pick up those barrels and haul them on their shoulders.
Yeah. It's bulky and awkward.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, the Catholic population ate dried shrimp regularly in the Lenten season, every year.
Oh, yeah.
About when did dried shrimp start to become a real commodity, of some importance here?
It's always been because it was because they didn't have any way to preserve meats and stuff like this. They would preserve stuff they would soak it in lard and stuff like this, and it would, in those big vats and stuff like this. But as far as dried fish and dried shrimp was concerned, it was something that they could preserve and they could keep it all year long. It was like beef jerky or something like that. Those guys out west would carry beef jerky with them and eat that. Well, the same thing here. The Chinese would eat dried shrimp, just like beef jerky was used. And it was always a tremendous product. If you go back in history and you take the when the Spanish and English was when the Spanish tried to invade England, I think it was in 1512 or something like that, they never stopped the trade of codfish between the two countries because it was that much of an important product and such. And I'm assuming that it was the dried shrimp was the same thing in the Far East, and such. And in fact, dried shrimp is even supposed to be better than dried codfish because of doesn't have any of those harmful, nothing to get rancid with. And the art of drying fish and dried shrimp probably dates back to sometime right after the invention of fire, because people needed to preserve foods and stuff like that. And that was, drying it is the best way to do it. So
I don't know if Carl asked you, but the Chinese have played a very important role at least on the platforms, and we know at least one wholesaler in New Orleans.
Oh, yes.
The Quan Sun Company.
Uh-huh.
Yet we can't find much information about the Chinese. If you have any knowledge, anyway, about Chinese, we'd appreciate your comments.
As far as the Chinese,
yeah.
As far as when they came here?
Yes.
To,
and
well, the Chinese, when they first came to the United States, Chinese are very secretive about who they are, what they are, or anything about it, because they've been oppressed so harshly in their countries, not just recently, but for the whole history of it. And when they first came to the United States, a lot of them had to come here illegally. And, you know, they would take, you know, a name of some kind and stuff like this. And nobody knew how many Chinese were here or anything like that. And still to this day, some of the Chinese people are very, very particular about who they, you know, if they don't know you real good, they won't trust you enough to let you take their picture or whatever it is. And even if they're just regular citizens of the United States, to some extent, I understand that happens. Now, I think the younger generation today is a little bit more lenient, but some of the older people are a little bit more particular about it. But it stems back from the early days when they first started coming to the United States. They had to smuggle them in. And when they started doing that, they wanted to come to the United States to work on the railroads when they were coming across the United States. You know, then when they were trying to get them to join each other, and they were very good workers and such. And they could get into tight spaces because they weren't as big as the Irishmen that were there, and they worked hard and stuff like that. But they didn't like to eat too much of the American food. They liked their own food, rice and shrimp and seafoods and certain vegetables and stuff like that. And when they first came to the United States in the San Francisco Bay, that's where they really, I think, was the first dried shrimp operation in the United States. And if you go to San Francisco and you go out on the wharf, there's an old boat that's sitting out there where they used to catch shrimp in the bay of in San Francisco Bay. And the guy, forestry servant agent will tell you about the drying of the shrimp of the Chinese when got there. And the Chinese in San Francisco, on the top of San Francisco, you have one area. But below San Francisco, they made tunnels. And it's tunnels all over underneath San Francisco and stuff like this. And they keep a lot of foodstuffs and things like that. And my grandfather had gone to Chinatown probably in the 1930s, 1940s and stuff like that. And he went to see some of the people he was selling shrimp to in Chinatown with his broker. And he brought him underneath down there. And not only were they selling dried shrimp and had food stuff down there, they had other things that weren't, they had opium dens and stuff like that down there. And a lot of people were down there sleeping and doing stuff that they kind of against the law, but it's not just the Chinese. They had a lot of people doing that. It was a little bit under the cover. But when they started coming here to work on the railroads and such, they needed something to eat, and so they spread out trying to look for certain areas. And Louisiana happened to be similar to the climate that they had in China, with the marshes and bays and freshwater marshes and bays and stuff like this. And they came here and they started rice farming here. And with the rice farming, they also started drying shrimp. And while they did that, they had a lot of Cajun people here who was trapping furs, and they were drying, they had come from Acadia, and they had been drying fish and stuff like that up in Acadia. So it was a natural match for those. So the Chinese showed them how to make those platforms and stuff like this, build that up on the marshes and things like this. And the Acadians and them, they all, worked together, and they learned how to make their livings together, and which was good, And so the Chinese got the dry shrimp to eat while they were building those railroads, I think. And the Americans learned how to make a living. So it was all pretty good. And when my grandfather had got into it, they had been preserving the dried shrimp and fish and stuff like this. They had some Chinese that lived here, and they had Cajun people that lived here and stuff like that. And Filipinos. Filipinos was, like you were telling me, you know, not saying, telling you, but Manila Village. And, you know, that's in, and that was the Filipinos and Chinese together that were there. And so there's a population of Filipinos in New Orleans that their families have dried shrimp. And that's what I was trying to get you to do with Robert Hoy. And their family was Mr. Hoy and Mr. Hall. And they were in New Orleans on St. Louis Street. And they had a big complex there on St. Louis Street. I think it was across the street from the Mint. And they had apartments around there where the Chinese were staying, and they were I call it a quad, but you know, it was all open area and stuff like that. They used to haul the shrimp there, and he would work the shrimp, and the people that lived in those apartments would work for him. And they would ship that shrimp all over the place. And, but of course, I, you know, that's just my idea about it. You'd have to talk to Robin, he could tell you that. But I remember those people when I was little and going there with my daddy and to get some shrimp from them. And then later on, as I got older, Mr. Hoy and Mr. Hong had passed away, and Miss G was in there, and that was their either sister or aunt or somebody. And then Robert Hoy's mother was there. And, but they have a really interesting history. And Robert was a physics teacher at UNO. And, he's got a lot of knowledge about his family and stuff like that. And that's a really interesting history problem as well. You could probably get some good information from him. So, anything else?
Not this time. We've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, I don't know how good I did.
Oh, but, hey, you're just telling the truth.
Oh, no, I lied a little bit.
Oh, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. We'll never know.
If y'all need to make a reshoot, I might be able to.